Hi, my name is Kim Mutterson, co-dean of Rutgers Law School in Camden, and this is The Power of Attorney. Today, my very special guest, although all of them are very special, is Sean LaTourette, who is a 2009 graduate from Rutgers Law School. And we, I hope, are going to have a pretty wide-ranging conversation today because he's got lots of interesting things to talk about. So let me start first, Sean, by thanking you for taking the time to talk to me today.
You're welcome, but really, I want to thank you for asking me to join you. The praises I have heard some. Thank you for the work you're doing on behalf of the entire Rutgers community and the broader New Jersey community and LGBT community in particular.
Thank you so much. Absolutely. So the way I always like to start these conversations is asking folks for their origin story, right? What is it, given all the things that you could have done with your life, why did you ultimately decide that law school and being a lawyer is what was for you?
I don't know. I think that's the best answer. I think that the best answer is I don't know. Let me back up and correct that because I know why I'm a lawyer. I know why I'm an environmental lawyer. What I mean is I didn't know that at the origin, much like I didn't know I was a gay man at the origin. I think when I think about my origin story, it is one that I'm proud of, but I would not have imagined to find myself where I am today if I were, you know, 5-year-old me. And I grew up in a working poor family that really struggled a lot. No one in my family had a college education. And actually, my cousin's daughter is now the second person to go to college.
Okay.
And I'm really proud of that.
That's great.
She wants to be a scientist. And because I'm at the Department of Environmental Protection, she asked me to introduce her to a microbiologist. I'm like, yes, someone speaks my language. So in any event, you know, I come from a family that is, you know, a blue collar at best, and where no one had a sense of, or if they did, I didn't know it, of higher education. Right. And what that could do for opening one's eyes and heart and all of that. So when I was real young, I thought, you know, I'll do what my family does. We're hardworking folks. We're going to, you know, I'll get a job and I'll get an apartment and I'll, you know, have a good car and all that good stuff. But I was really bullied in school as a kid. And it made me not want to go to high school with the kids that I went to grade school with. And when I was in the 8th grade, we got a presentation about vocational technical high school. And 20 plus years ago, vocational high school in New Jersey wasn't what it is today. Right? I'm a proud graduate of the Middlesex County Vocational Technical High School system. But at that time, there wasn't a Woodbridge Academy, and there wasn't the technical school that's on the Middlesex County College campus. It was, you know, what has historically been, you know, trades work. And right. I thought, well, this is great. I will go to this trade school, and I'll get a job, and it'll happen a little sooner, and it seemed great. And I wouldn't be around those really mean kids. So that's what I decided to do. And my family was just like, sure, right? Now, if one of if it were reversed, like now one of my daughters had come to me and said, I want to go to trade school, well, let's have that conversation, right? Let's talk about why you want that versus something else, and let's help you make the best decision you can. And I had a great experience there. I went to Woodbridge Vo-Tech. I grew up in Middlesex County. I still live in Middlesex County. I love it here. And at that time, the schools were divided in a very gender way. And in Perth Amboy, they had auto machine shop and electrical work and all this sort of stuff, fondly referred to as the boys' Vo-Tech. Then there was Woodbridge, which had cosmetology and fashion design and cooking and baking, and that was fondly referred to as the girls' Vo-Tech. And I aptly chose the girls' Vo-Tech. And there was a program called Automated Office Technology, right, which was, I think, then in 1994. The more PC way of saying secretary. And so I was the I was the only male in this program, and I actually was inducted into the New Jersey Equity Hall of Fame for being the only man in an all female area of study.
Nice.
I did automated office technology. I got put into a job as a file clerk at a law firm. at the age 16, and it changed my life. I think that's the origin story.
Was that the first time you had ever stepped into a law firm?
No. I carry my stepfather's last name. So once we went to a law firm, so that he could formally adopt me. But beyond that, yes, it was my first time in any environment like that. And I found it supercharging.
Right.
That was the beginning of everything, I guess.
I love that. That seems like that would be such a transformative experience at that age, you know, to be in this space with people who not only have gone to college, they've gone to law school, so they've had lots of higher education. They're working in a space that is a very sort of high-powered, high-charging kind of profession, a profession that's held in pretty high esteem. And so as you were there as a 16-year-old watching all of these people doing this work, what was it that made you say, that might be something I could do, or it might be something I might want to do?
I don't know that I thought of myself as a lawyer at that time, but it was also, it was a firm that was doing victims and rights work. So they were also helping. Mm. And I thought that that was really, I guess, noble.
Yeah.
And the whole experience opened my eyes. I don't think I really understood what possibility was until I walked in those doors.
Mm-hmm.
And it just took on its own life from there while I worked for a law firm for 2 years while I was, they put you to work in Votech at 16, so you're a junior. So you work for your junior and your senior year. You spend half the day doing your sort of core ed. And then, you know, after lunch, you go to work. So I'd work 6 hours a day every day as a junior and a senior in high school. And I just grew to really love it and then found a paralegal job, you know, a couple days after graduation. And then that sort of became my career for a while, being a paralegal. And I tried all different sorts of things. And every different step, every new sort of area of law and, you know, helping to support lawyers just kind of kept the world kind of kept opening up a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you're a double Rutgers guy.
Yes.
So first you went to undergrad and as you say, you were the first in your family to get a college degree, which is extraordinary. And then you came to us for law school. And I wonder, I mean, I'm sure that the transition to college was a significant transition, but I'd love to talk a little bit more about the transition from college into law school. Now, you know, at Rutgers, one of the things that I love is that we, you know, we get a number of students who are first gen, and who have, you know, varying levels of familiarity with what law school might be like, but everybody sort of has a different story about what it's like to, you know, walk in those doors and to sit in those classrooms, which are very different from being in undergrad. So what was that transition like for you, the you know, heading into law school?
Okay, so quick, I feel like there's a second origin story.
Okay.
So while I was working as a paralegal, I thought I should really go to college, right? And so I worked for 10 years as a parent, and I slowly went to college at night. And I started slowly going to college at County College, Middlesex. And I tried lots of different classes, and I struggled to find my footing at first. And there was even one semester where I just felt like I couldn't do it. And I just stopped going to class. And that left a stain on my transcript. And then after I got it together, you know, I went back and I got, you know, straight A's. So then I transferred from County College to Rutgers. And I did that full time at night. So I was working full time during the day, going to Rutgers full time at night and continuing to do victims' rights work. I sort of took on the shape of a community organizer as a paralegal, and I would go into communities where folks were suffering from cancer illness, from contaminated drinking water, sort of like my discovery of environmental work. I worked with these two amazing environmental lawyers who just inspired me. And they said I should go to law school. And I worked for them for 6 years while I was, you know, finishing my undergrad degree. And I think I kind of had an understanding of what to expect from law school in a way. But I also didn't have the college experience of, you know, going and living at school and making friends there. Because I was doing it, you know, while working. It gave me great time management skills,
Sure.
Not so much on the social skills.
Yeah.
But then I said, you know what? I'll go to law school full time. I think I doubted myself and that I wouldn't do well. And I didn't do great on the LSATs, you know, because it's hard for a standardized test to measure the worth of a person or the way
of
life.
Of course.
Nonetheless. And I loved every second of it. You know, folks in the profession will talk about how terrible law school was. I loved it.
Good.
I loved being in the classroom and having insightful discussion with my peers or even the barbs in con law class when you realize that not everybody is of the same ideology.
Right.
But it was an exceptional experience, and I the best things to say when people ask me about law school, and they always do a double take. Really? I hear it's awful. I thought it was great. And Rutgers and Camden in particular, I took a good class at Net New York too. The environment was just so supportive. I loved it there.
Good, good, good. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, I think that, you know, people, the vision that they have of law school, there is certainly some truth to it, right? It's very different from undergrad. It can be all consuming in lots of ways. It is sort of fundamentally about teaching you both how to speak a different language and how to think differently. So, you know, it asks a lot of you intellectually, but that's what's so exciting about it as well, right? I mean, yeah. I feel like I left law school with language to talk about the world that I had not had before. And that was really valuable.
Yeah, no question. I couldn't agree more with that.
So you finished up law school. And then usually what people do after law school is they try to find a job. So you left law school. And what was your first job as a lawyer?
So my first job as a lawyer was a really large law firm that I was recruited into. I did well in school, it turned out. I shouldn't have doubted myself as much as did. I had a good 1L GPA, and I didn't know this going to law school, but, you know, if you are, you know, looking to go a big law firm route, which I wasn't necessarily, I didn't even know it existed.
Right.
But I had a good 3.9 GPA after 1L year, and apparently from the big law perspective, like, that's the key to the kingdom. If your 1L year is the key, if that's the kingdom you want. Turns out I didn't want that. Mm-hmm. But
right.
So I did the on-campus interview thing, and I ended up with an offer from Latham & Watkins, which is one of the large, you know, probably one of the top five largest law firms on the globe. And
yep.
I wanted to do that because they had the largest environmental program of any law firm anywhere, and I wanted to see that side of the work. It was obviously defense work, which was not what I learned as a paralegal. It was much more, it was all victims' rights. But it too was eye-opening and a great training ground. Because I had experience, I ended up on a trial my first year as a first-year attorney at a large law firm, ended up on a trial. It's unbelievable.
That is incredibly rare.
So those were all remarkable experiences.
Excellent. So you were doing, and it's actually not that unusual to find people. I mean, you see it in criminal law all the time, right? People who start at the prosecutor's office and then, you know, do that for a while and then, you know, switch gears and start doing, you know, public defender work or open their own criminal defense firm. And, you know, I think a lot of that is that you can learn so much by being on both sides of an issue, and it helps you understand it much more in depth. But it seems like once you got that bug for environmental law, and not just environmental law, but really environmental justice, that became something that was going to be the future for you. So when did you sort of make that transition from sort of defense side environmental work to the kind of work that you're doing now?
Yeah. So when I was, I think that sort of bug starts when I was in the paralegal organizing kind of capacity, where it was just so obvious that poor people, especially poor people of color, suffered greater environmental externalities than others.
Yep.
And that notion just sort of cut through all of the work that I did throughout my career, right? Whether it was from as a paralegal and organizing and seeing that the folks that were getting cancer were actually the folks that were at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. And then that continued, I continued to see those same things in other facets of my work, whether, you know, I was at Latham and working on natural resource damage cases or large class actions. And then when I transitioned to come back to New Jersey, so to speak, because I was in New York and New Jersey at first at Latham, I did work again at Lieberman & Blecker, which is a more plaintiff side type firm, and did toxic injury work there. So, you know, it was obvious from doing litigation, which was probably about half of my portfolio as a private practicing lawyer, and then also doing a lot of infrastructure work. The communities where some of the more heavily polluting sites were located was painfully coincident with the communities that had the least. And so that just became a point of interest for me. You know, it's sort of hard to do environmental justice in the types of roles that I was in before. But it was something that I studied and had, you know, whenever I had the chance, maybe through the State Bar Association, to put together panels on the issues and invite advocates, was something that always stuck with me.
Great. And then eventually you transitioned to government work, which I also think is a really interesting transition for folks when you go from private practice into working for the government. So two questions on that. One is what sort of inspired you to make that move from private practice into working for the government? And then once you had made that transition, what are the ways in which your experience of that kind of work was different from or is different from what you experienced in private practice?
So I in my last role in private practice, I was a partner at Gibbons, focused on litigation, environmental litigation, and infrastructure development work. At that time, it was 2018. Governor Murphy had just been elected and was beginning to appoint his cabinet. And I've never been a particularly political person. I had political views. Oh, I had a lot of political views. But I've never been deeply engaged in the work of politics. When the commissioner of the DEP, like the secretary of the environment, so to speak, for the state, was appointed, there was a search for a chief counsel for that agency. And my name was on a short list of environmental lawyers who would be worth her talking to. And we met and hit it off. And I went to work for the Department of Environmental Protection, which is one of the largest state agencies. We've got about 3,400 employees, scientists, lawyers, regulators, permit writers. We even run the state parks. I started as chief counsel and began, you know, kind of running what was a in-house legal shop, and had a great relationship with our attorney general, and started doing some big affirmative impact litigation, which was very exciting.
So can you explain to folks who are listening, who aren't necessarily lawyers, when we talk about impact litigation, and particularly when we talk about affirmative impact litigation, what kinds of cases are those, and what's the goal when you do a case like that?
So from the environmental perspective, I consider affirmative impact litigation to be a mechanism for achieving change. It is, in some ways, the lawyering equivalent of government, right? It is a way to fundamentally change the approach to law that will have far lasting impacts beyond that one individual case. And from the perspective of what we were doing at that time at DEP in 2018, it was about turning the page. The approach to environmental enforcement was very different. And so the focus of that impact litigation was to breathe new life into the environmental enforcement priorities in the state. And there was a number of things that we did in order to do that, including taking on some large corporations that have so thoroughly polluted our groundwater and our surface water with what we call forever chemicals, right? These chemicals that never degrade. They bioaccumulate and they never go away. And so, we have some of these chemicals are called perfluoroalkyl substances that are everywhere. And somebody's got to clean that up. Mm-hmm. And we're holding folks accountable to do this.
Got it. So there are two things that popped into my head as you were just talking. One of them is sort of helping people understand when you bring litigation like that, what's the statute or what are the policies, et cetera, under which you are able to pursue that kind of action. But the second question and the other thing that I was saying that I really, really love is the level of technical knowledge that lawyers often have to gain in order to be able to do the kind of work that they're doing.
Yeah.
And in this area, I mean, just listening to the words that were just coming out of your mouth, this is a place where you definitely have to sort of learn things outside of the law in order to be able to enforce the law. So you can take those in whichever order works for you. But I think both of them are really interesting.
Yeah. So I'll go with that. I'll do the latter first. And part of what I love about being a lawyer, even though I'm not functioning as a lawyer right now, is the way that lawyering and perhaps litigation in particular, depending on the type, is like an umbrella discipline. And mm-hmm. and when you crack that umbrella open, so many things can get collected within the sphere of what you are litigating or counseling on. So for example, if I am bringing impact litigation with respect to forever chemicals, I'm going to need to learn about a lot of different things. I'm going to need to learn about how the chemical bioaccumulates in fish tissue. And mm-hmm. I'm going to need to learn about how that chemical circulates through the environment. So you need to learn things about the water cycle and how, a concept called fate and transport, like how far does it go and where does it go and why and what is the chemical cycle to which it is a part. I love that about lawyering, that you can, in the course of any one engagement, sink your teeth in and become sort of an expert of that particular topic. Because you have to learn a lot. If you're going to go into a room and try to depose a hydrogeologist about why a chemical is behaving in a waterway the way it is, you're going to need to learn a lot as a lawyer about what that profession is all about. It's really an exceptional opportunity when you get to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
To the other question about how you bring that impact litigation and under what statutes you bring them, part of the reason to bring impact litigation is to expand the reach of a law. And so let's take, for example, an act like the Clean Water Act, for example. There's so much case law out there about what different sections, different provisions of the Clean Water Act will allow. Part of the, in terms of, compensating for an injury to a waterway or getting somebody to, some company or some person to clean up the mess thing, impact litigation can really shape the extent of liability. And mm-hmm. when it comes to the environment, with how long environmental ills can persist, you want to make sure, as, at least if you're in the role that I am now in the state government, that you have the ability to deliver that level of accountability. And so part of the impact litigation is about those very principles.
Yeah. So we should probably tell people what role you're in now. So folks understand. So we were talking about the litigation that you were doing at the DEP, but now you have moved into a role as the acting commissioner. And so can you talk about what that work is that you're doing now?
Sure. So the state government, structure very much like the federal government, where the governor has a cabinet and the cabinet members run agencies, right? On the federal level, the president appoints a administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, right? On the state level, the governor appoints a commissioner of environmental protection. It's the same thing. The commissioner is both an advisor to the governor as well as the head of the agency. So in 2018, I first joined DEP as chief counsel to who was then the commissioner, a storied environmental lawyer named Catherine McCabe, who I think is just amazing. And she decided to retire. And she's she built a life in public service 40 plus years and wow. Made great change herself. When I joined as chief counsel, I then, after a while, I became her chief of staff, just sort of like the right hand, and then became, from an operations perspective, and then became the deputy commissioner, so the second in charge of the agency. So when she retired, the governor appointed me to take her place. And so now I am serving, you know, pending formal nomination to the Senate as the acting commissioner of environment. And so I run the DEP.
So you get to sort of decide things like, you know, what's the direction that the agency is going to go in? What are we going to prioritize? All of that good stuff.
Yes. So my job primarily, I guess it's two different jobs in a way. The first job is to care for the agency itself, right? It's a bureaucracy of 3,400 people with eight different specific divisions that do specific things that ultimately are in service of protecting public health and the environment. So whether it is ensuring that the drinking water systems that bring water to our homes are actually bringing us clean water, that the folks that make a mess of a property and spill oil are actually cleaning it up to make sure that we have clean air. We have a whole program that is about monitoring and improving upon the quality of the air in the state. So that's one of the functions, being the chief executive over all of that bureaucracy. The other function is to drive the governor's affirmative agenda with respect to environmental protection and the priorities around that. Under Governor Murphy, we have a number of important priorities, climate change being chief among them, the enhanced protection of water being another, the care of our watersheds, which are the greater environment in which our streams exist, being another one, and doing that all through the lens of environmental justice and equity, right? The idea that for us to do environmental justice, it's not another program. It's not like you do environmental justice like you do control air pollution, right? It is the spirit that guides all the other work. And so I help to create programs and policies to do those things.
Excellent. I do want to talk about climate change and the work that can be done on a state level. And of I don't know when we're going to be broadcasting this, but I think one of the things that lots of us are thinking about right now is the storm in Texas and the utter failure of the electrical grid in the wake of that storm. And so, you know, I think that there are sort of two levels that we have to work on here. One is obviously the federal level, but states also have a really important role to play in dealing with climate change. So, and different states are going to take different positions, right? You're in New Jersey, which puts you in a very different mindset than, say, somebody in Texas or, you know, some other parts of the country. So, you know, what do you see as the role that states should be playing in, you know, what is one of the most important issues of our time?
So, from my perspective, states should do two things. The state should adapt their inherently backward-looking legal structures to account for what is a present and future problem. So much of environmental law is focused on the lessons of the past and not pointed at the challenges of the future. So turning that ship around is important, and we're working on that here in New Jersey. The other thing that is really important is for states to be aggressive in order to demonstrate leadership and bring other people along. And, you know, thankfully, because of the leadership that we have in New Jersey, both from on the part of the governor and on part of our legislature, which has been proactive in this space, we're getting to do both of those things, which I find really exciting. So there are two through lines on climate policy in New Jersey. So the first is how we reduce the next is how we respond. What I mean by that is we have to mitigate the climate emissions, or what I often refer to as the emission of climate pollutants, whether that's green, whether that is methane, whether that is carbon dioxide, whether that is something like black carbon, which particularly affects our most disadvantaged communities in a negative way, how we are working regulatorily and legislatively to pull down on those emissions, to limit them, to cap them in some respects. And that is, there are many legal and policy mechanisms for doing that. And then the second piece is how we build resilience, right? This notion of climate change as a distant risk is fallacy, right? It is here now. And if we're all honest with ourselves, it's going to get a lot worse. Right. So one of the things that we did was to put together the first ever, at the Department of Environmental Protection, the first ever climate science report that is state-specific, right? So you can read all the stuff in the International Panel on Climate Change. All of it is great, great work. But it can often leave you feeling like it's abstract, like how does it apply to me? And so we kind of really brought it home and said, here's what we're going to see in New Jersey. We did all this great science about sea level rise, which is one of our greatest risks. And the science that we did and the modeling that we performed with folks at Rutgers and many other institutions says that by 2050, we face a risk of 2 feet of sea level rise. No matter what we do, no matter how many electric vehicles we put on the road, no matter how many wind turbines we build and power plants we close, because that's a product of emissions we already put in the atmosphere over the course of the Industrial Revolution, right? We are going to lose land mass as a result of that. That is a sobering and hard reality. Between 2050 and 2150, depending on what we do today, how many EVs we put on the road, how many wind turbines we build, we have a chance to avoid the worsening, right? So by 2100, our projection under even a moderate scenario where we are doing more renewable energy, but it's going to take a long time to get there, we'll see 5 feet of sea level rise.
Oof.
Right? And then by 2150, we could see as much as 10. Under the worst case scenario in New Jersey, which we don't think we'll see, but just to put it in perspective, under the worst case scenario, our new shoreline is I-95. I don't know about you, but I like my beach to be Asbury Park, not East Brunswick.
Wow.
Right? And that's what we've got to deal with. How do you get ready for that? How do you help people wake up to that reality?
Right.
So that's one of our biggest challenges. And there is so much we can do, right? Mm-hmm. Starting by making sure that what we build today can stand the test of tomorrow. We should at least be building things today that are ready for that 2 feet of sea level rise and hopefully for the 5 feet, right? We should be elevating things more on the shoreline. So we are going through, at my agency, a regulatory modernization effort where we're going through every regulation and bringing it into the future and accounting for the fact of climate change. And it's very controversial, right? Folks in the community of home builders or in other places, they don't want to see this happen. It's a change to the status quo, and that's hard.
Yeah.
But what's harder is somebody losing their home. And while maybe the folks that are building things today are less concerned about that because they're going to build it and sell it, it's actually my whole job to care about that person 30 years from now.
One of the things that is so challenging with this kind of work is the number of people who continue to deny that climate change is a thing, or who continue to deny that even if there is something going on, they deny that it's a result of the kinds of things that we are doing to the planet and on the planet. And this is really an impossible question, and I recognize that as I'm asking it, but I'm still going to ask it. How do we get people on board with the kinds of things, as you say, that need to happen now so we can avoid the disaster, you know, 20 years from now, 50 years from now, when frankly, you know, a lot of the folks who are climate deniers are thinking, I'm not going to be here. Right? So why are you making this my problem?
Yeah. How do you deal with denialism? With honesty. You are honest with as many people as you can, and you work hard to bring them along. I had the honor last week of being invited to a special committee on climate in the state assembly. And the first question I was asked is, what has DEP learned about climate change in the last 10 years? I'm like, well, I can't answer you. There's a report on that. But let me tell you what we're doing. So I went through some of the things that we're doing. And then some climate scientists spoke. And then a representative from a trade organization, a business organization, spoke at the end about why what I was proposing was so preposterous. And the conversation was thick with denialism. And it's a lesson for me, and you've got to meet people where they are, right? So to my counterparts in business and industry who might say, Sean, are you crazy? You're going to suggest that new development on the barrier islands should be built 5 feet above the ground level, right? The first floor should be 5 feet above. Well, no, I'm not crazy. And let me tell you why, if you do it this way, you have a value proposition to offer your customer, to offer your constituent. Because let's say I'm wrong. Let's say it's all wrong, and we're not going to see 5 feet of sea level rise by 2100. It's going to be 3. You know what will be? Pretty.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's the conversation that I try to have about it. And as painful as this pandemic has been, I think it has offered us an important perspective, which is that preparation matters. Being ready for the unthinkable thing, the thing that seems distant and far off and unlikely, it matters. And that is a function of government. That's why government exists, to help lift up people when they have the trouble lifting up themselves and to respond to something like this, except that it's going to be way worse. Way, way, way worse. And it doesn't have to be. With respect to the pandemic, you hear so many folks say, it didn't have to be this way. We've got to learn from it. We've got to learn from it. And if we over-prepare by elevating a few commercial structures, then we over-prepare. It's not going to kill the economy, right? Just like green energy isn't going to kill the economy. It is not the Green New Deal's fault that Texas decided to deregulate and to not invest in icing their equipment. They didn't do that because they're Texas and they thought they'd always be warm. But you want to know what happened? Climate change.
Right.
So we all have these lessons to learn. But I think the biggest lesson for me is just try to meet people where they are. That's what we did with the environmental justice law, right? We're now the only state in the country to have a meaningful environmental justice law.
Can you talk to me a little bit about that law? And again, you know, one of the things that I have found, I'm not a native of New Jersey. I moved here a few years actually after I came to Rutgers. I started in Philadelphia and eventually moved into New Jersey. But one of the things that I am really enjoying about New Jersey right now is that this is a state that is often at the vanguard, right? I mean, we are creating policies that are policies that other states will and should follow on a variety of different fronts: criminal justice, reproductive justice, and environmental justice. So, can you sort of talk about what that law is and what it helps us achieve?
Yeah, I'm happy to, because it is a passion of mine. One of the questions I get asked sometimes on panels where the defense bar is present is New Jersey a leader or is New Jersey an outlier?
Mm.
Let's make no mistake: New Jersey is a leader and always has been. There's been times where we've lost touch with that. This is not one of those times.
Mm-hmm.
We've been fortunate in New Jersey. If you know the federal law, the CERCLA or Superfund, right? That entire thing, the law on the federal level that has led to the cleanup of hazardous waste sites throughout the country, is based on a New Jersey law from 1977. That is who we need to be, right? And that's what the CJ law is about too. We know, there's make no mistake about it, the things that folks may not like to have in their backyards, whether it is a sewage treatment plant or a power plant or a recycling facility, they end up somewhere else. Where do they end up? They end up among the communities where folks are either so overtaxed by the structure of our society, that are working multiple jobs, that don't have the power or the knowledge, which is also a structural issue, to fight back, right? Mm-hmm. And so what happens is some of our low income and Black and Brown communities in particular become the path of least resistance for the location of the most highly polluting facilities. Now some will say, and there's truth to it, that those same locations are also the main thoroughfares, the main arteries of our transportation system. And from an economic standpoint, you need to be near a transportation hub to achieve certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Both things can be true at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the reason we see a higher proportion of polluting facilities in environmental justice communities is part of a larger problem, but it what it shows us is that we're not looking closely enough at the lived experience of these individual communities. And the reason we don't do that is because the law is not set up to do that, right? Mm-hmm. The way environmental law works, quick tangent, the way environmental law works is that we regulate, and the agencies like mine regulate the right to pollute, right? In order to live in a modern society, there is pollution. That is a fact. So environmental laws will exist to limit the amount of pollution. And what we look at as regulators and agencies like mine is whether every new facility, whatever it is, that is adding pollution is using the best technology to control that pollution. That's the only thing we ask. Mm. We don't ask about where it's going or who lives there or how many other polluting facilities they have. And so there becomes this concept of what's called cumulative impacts. The idea that one sewage plant is one thing, but five of them in one community is another. But we never look at the whole thing. We look at it issue by issue. To look at it in these little silos, that is the status quo. What we've done in this law is say, no, we are going to look at the community, and we're going to look at the environmental and public health stressors that exist in this community. And we're going to ask ourselves the question of whether this facility will add more, will work a disproportionate amount of pollution on this community versus other communities. And because it's about fundamental fairness. We have a subset of the population in this state, across the country, across the world, that bears a disproportionate burden of the pollution that we all together create. And it's about fairness. And so that's what we're doing with this law, and it empowers the environmental agency to say no to a permit that would work a disproportionate impact. And that was never before allowed. Folks try to achieve the same thing in the 90s using the Civil Rights Act, for example, and other mechanisms, and it failed miserably in the courts. It needed legislative power. So when I first came to DEP, we had a senator, Senator Troy Singleton, who took up the cause of this environmental justice bill that was originally spearheaded by someone else. The first meeting that I took in 2018 when I came to the agency was with the senator about this bill, and it wasn't right. Like, the spirit of what he wanted to do was right, but the bill itself wouldn't have done the thing it needed to do. So for 2 years, we worked together with his staff, with experts, with advocates, with folks in burdened communities, and we came up with a bill that was ready to go. And as COVID hit, and we see just laid bare these systemic inequities, that while that the communities that are facing a disproportionate burden of COVID are the same communities that have worsening levels of pollution, and that's not causal; it's correlational, but it's structural nonetheless.
Yep.
And so when that was just laid in front of the public, it gave this bill an opportunity to move, and it became law. And now we are, you know, doing what regulatory agencies do, making rules to implement laws. It sounds rather unsexy, but it's really, really energizing.
Right. Well, that's how the work gets done, right? It's not all sexy.
it really isn't.
Yeah. Yeah. And in particular, you know, when you talk about legislation and policymaking, you know, watching how that sausage gets made is not something that most of us would particularly enjoy. But, you know, that's the work that has to happen in order for us to get to the outcomes that we want. Well, let me shift gears a little bit in the time that we have left. You and I are both in our homes and we both have kids. And so, you know, one of the things that I think women in law often get asked about is, you know, how do you balance work and children? And men frequently don't get asked that question, but I think it's certainly a question worth asking. So I don't know exactly how old your kids are, but I think that you had kids when you were still in big law and then transitioned to working for the government. So I will never ask anybody how they meet that perfect equilibrium between home and the office, because there is no such thing. And there certainly isn't any such thing in the world where most of us, our homes have become our offices. You know, I would just really love to hear your thoughts about how frankly, how we as a profession really have done in terms of making this a profession that is caregiver friendly, whether it's kids or aging parents, and what we could be doing better or should be doing better.
We don't do a good job. Yeah. Societally, we don't do a good job,
right?
Whether it's a legal profession or any other profession. So I have 10-year-old twin girls, and I had them when I was at Latham & Watkins. And it was very clear to me that I was not going to be able to sustain that level of performance and be the kind of present parent that I wanted to be. And so, you know, that was part of what motivated me to move on to another environment. And that's not a reflection on Latham & Watkins. They have great programs to be supportive of working families. Many, many law firms do. So the problem isn't the law firm, the problem is us. Mm-hmm. Right? The problem is stepping back and seeing ourselves and our colleagues as whole people mm-hmm. that have lives that exist beyond the work product. And that when we support one another in serving those lives, we also serve the work.
Yep.
And I think that's a hard thing, particularly in a very white, very male-dominated profession in particular, where it's very binary, it's very type A, it's very gendered. And I mean, I can remember in my time at my last law firm before going into government, you know, I was on partner track, right? And I had one day of getting ready at 5 o'clock to run for my train so I can get to get home, to get to the parking lot, to get into the car, to pick up the kids from daycare before the 6 o'clock mark in order to avoid being charged an extra $1 per minute per child.
Right.
And I'm leaving out the door and a young associate sees me packing up and says to me, "Half day?"
Wow. Wow.
And I just chuckled.
Yeah.
But that's the culture.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
The culture is, the problematic culture is one where we derive our value from our not even actual productivity, our perceived
yes.
productivity.
Right.
And then, you know, this individual had no idea what I was working on, had no idea that I'd be on calls with clients and on the train and writing a brief when I got home. No clue, right? But it's so indicative of the culture that we all need to work together to change.
Yeah.
Right? We need to support working fathers the same way we support, or at least purport to support working mothers, which that alone has been hard fought, right?
Yeah.
Come on.
Right.
We can do better than this. But what it takes to do better is for people at the top to see them, to see their role in it, and to want to change it, and not just to want to change it because it's great for talent acquisition or it sounds good in a glossy trifold that you get out on OCI recruiting day, but because you actually need it. So that's my perspective.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, there are so many things that are potentially going to be different as we come out of this pandemic. And, you know, one of the things that we have the potential to do is really rethink a lot about the structure of our workplaces and, you know, creating more flexibility for people. As you say, you know, respecting the fact that we want folks to have whole lives and we want them to be actually productive, not just performing productivity because seeing you sitting in an office somehow says you're doing really important things when you could be, you know, watching YouTube videos and all sorts of other things that people do when they're sitting behind their computer at their job.
I'd say I like to think of it this way. Let's be productive, not performative.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed, we're getting closer to that. We'll see what the next several years bring. And fingers crossed, we're getting closer to a place where we're really going to be responsive to climate change in the way that we should be. You know, I think, you know, one of the things that I certainly think about, and I think a lot of people who are parents think about is, you know, I'm not going to be here X number of years from now, but I sure hope my kids and my grandkids are, and that we are leaving them a world in which they can actually live. And hopefully that's something that everybody can get behind. So Thank you so much for your time. This was a really wonderful conversation. The work that you're doing is so necessary and so vital. And I'm grateful to you for doing that work. And hopefully some of our Rutgers students will end up following in your footsteps in the years to come. So we'll keep a dynasty at the DEP.
That would be fantastic. And Kim, thank you again for having me. And it's been a pleasure to talk to you a bit. And I hope we have more opportunities to get to know one another and spend time together.
As do I.
The Power of Attorney is produced by Rutgers Law School. With two locations, minutes from Philadelphia and New York City, Rutgers Law offers the prestige and reputation of a large, nationally known university with a personal small campus experience. Learn more by visiting law.rutgers.edu.